WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is actor Elliot Gould. He became a star in the late 60s and early 70s with such films as Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, MASH, The Long Goodbye, Little Murders, and California Split. He was a leading man with eccentric good looks, a neurotic energy, and a quirky sense of humor. But after the mid-70s, his career took a downward turn. In 1984, he starred in a short-lived TV series, ER, about an emergency room physician. TV Guide featured an article about the show that said that Gould had been exiled to B-movies because of reports that his bizarre behavior made him difficult to work with. Gould's latest movie, Inside Out, about an agoraphobic, opened and quickly closed in New York over the summer, but it's scheduled to open on the West Coast this week. Elliot Gould was in Philadelphia today for a conference at Temple University on college campus activism. One of the organizers, Bobby Seale, met Gould when he played the role of attorney Leonard Wineglass in a cable TV movie based on the Chicago 7 trial. I spoke with Elliot Gould earlier today. Before he made movies, he starred in several Broadway musicals. He got his start in show business as a child, singing and dancing on local TV shows and in the Borscht Belt. I asked him if it was his idea to go into show business at such an early age.
Oh, no. I didn't think that I was capable, nor was I terribly willing to perform or expose myself in any form of performance.
your parents were behind this?
My parents were advised attending a school for singing and dancing would perhaps help me come out of myself and deal with my being rather withdrawn and very shy. And
since you started off in show business a little unwillingly, when you came of age, did you try to get out and did you consider a career as a lawyer or a doctor or a businessman instead of show business?
Well, as I like to reflect, the meaning of career emanates from a Spanish word, which means an obstacle course, like in a racetrack, and mine is extending itself. I was brought to Charlie Lowe's Song and Dance School, where they also taught personality, and I was asked whether I would consider to learn to tap dance, and I thought as an 8 or 9 year old boy that it didn't seem to be unmasculine, and although I would have preferred to have said I'd rather be a fireman or a cowboy, I wasn't aware of being a child. I was rather serious-minded. And I thought my ambition would be to blow a bugle and have the walls come tumbling down, but I knew that that was written someplace and it happened before. So I acquiesced to learning how to tap. The first time I appeared in a troupe with some of my fellow students as a rather precocious group of singing and dancing kids, there were two adult performances happening as well. One was Buck and Bubbles, who were great vaudevillians. In later years, I worked with John Bubbles. I staged something for him. He was the original Sport and Life in Porgy and Bess. And the other performer was Josh White, Sr., a great folk singer. And I believe in history, and I thought that was great. I could memorize things, but my heart wasn't in it. I had no real belief in myself at that time.
You started as an adult in musical comedy before you made it into movies, and I've never seen you sing. I've only seen you in your movies.
Have you heard me sing?
No, I never heard you sing.
Oh. Didn't you see any of my Saturday Night Lives?
I did, actually. But
you saw me sing, but you weren't listening.
Well, what did you sing on them? I'm trying to remember.
I sang, the second time I did the show, I did Times Have Changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got a shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they would try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock would land on them in olden days, a glimpse, and so on and so forth. And when I finished it, I said, and tonight, everything goes. I like that. No one wrote that for me. The first time I did Let Yourself Go, Irving Berlin, as you listen to the band, don't you get a something or other, bubble, I guess. And then I did Crazy Rhythm, which I used to perform in the Catskill Mountains. Crazy Rhythm, here's the doorway, you go your way, I'll go my way. I worked at the Palace Theater on the same bill as Cliff Edwards, who was the voice of Jiminy Cricket.
And Ukulele Ike.
Ukulele Ike, Fascinating Rhythm, that was his theme song. And I followed Smith and Dale, who were the original Sunshine Boys, you know.
Well, you've actually resolved something for me, because I was always trying to imagine you breaking out into song on the musical stage. And in so many of your movies, you have these great kind of off-the-cuff, half-mumbled lines that are so funny, little throwaway lines. And to think of you exuberantly breaking out into song on Broadway was always a stretch for me, but now I feel like
well,
I've experienced
it. Well, I started
it.
Out in the chorus. I mean, I love it now, you know, I really do.
You love what, stage? The stage? Musicals?
I love to sing, mm-hmm. and I also appreciate movement. Groucho Marx was a very good friend of mine in his latter days. He used to let me shave him with his electric razor while he'd stand and watch reruns of Jack Benny and Burns and Allen. And he said I didn't have to think about dancing, that I move so well, and for me to just to continue to move. And then he said that I didn't have to act like him any longer. He thought I was good enough to be like Harpo.
Oh, well.
You look a little like Harpo.
I look like Harpo?
A little bit, yeah.
I talk a little bit more, I guess. My guest is actor Elliot Gould. When you were also early on in your career, you studied with Lee Strasberg at the Actor Studio. And I think at about that time you went into psychoanalysis. Was that something that you had to do to study with Strasberg?
No. Actually, at that time, I was living with my first wife. And, of course, we were married. Yes, we were. And I went to Mr. Strasberg's private classes, not at the Actor's Studio. They were at Carnegie Hall. And I took three sessions with him. At the same time, I saw a psychoanalyst. And I took more than three sessions with him. And it was a good experience. I have a very good reference as to what the psychoanalytic community does.
Does it help in acting to have been psychoanalyzed?
It certainly helps to understand yourself.
The role that really put you on the map in the movies was Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. That wasn't the role, that was the movie.
The role was Ted.
The role was Ted, yeah. Right. And I wonder what you thought of those characters. These were two sets of couples who had decided to experiment with spouse swapping and group sex. What did you think about the role that you were playing? What did you think of that person?
Well, the first time that the material was presented to me, I was extremely skeptical. And I didn't think that I could trust it in relation to my ethical and moral ideals. And so I shied away from it. And then it came back to me, and I went in and I met Larry Tucker and Paul Mazursky, who wrote it. And, of course, it was Paul Mazursky's first directorial assignment. And there's a wonderful bedroom scene between my character and Diane Cannon, who played my wife. An extremely funny, very real encounter between a sexually starved husband and his wife. And the rhythms of the scene were so good, and it seemed to be very positive, because when I read with them, I felt that I could do it. Diane wasn't cast at that time, and we had to do some screen tests. And I discovered my first objective relationship in that picture, whereas the four characters each had a fantasy. My wife's fantasy was that every man in her mind would want to be with her, and it was dramatized as a dance, and every male in the picture had a ticket to give to her so she could dance with every male, and I was there as well. We were working on a soundstage at Columbia Pictures. At the same time, Spencer Tracy was next door at another soundstage doing Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Miss Hepburn. And we had to break for union regulations. We had about 400 or 500 men and this one woman. And so I decided that I really had no place to go, and everybody went off the stage. And I stayed there, and it was just the camera and me. And it was the first time, because when I'm working, my mind is open, that I realized that what I was afraid of was that the camera would show me as I really felt about myself, which I was not terribly
comfortable with.
That's right. I wasn't too comfortable with myself. But I realized then that the camera was inanimate, and it was me that was frightening myself, not a camera. So I made my peace with the camera, and it became my very good friend. And ever since then, that's worked for me.
You know, one thing I think actors are so lucky to have is lines, lines that are written for them and people that they could be. It must be so exciting to have a personality that you can fit yourself into and become, where you don't have to think of, well, what am I going to say? The lines are written for you. And if it's a good role, the lines are written for you very well.
Well, I consider the lines to be one thing, and the words that compose the lines are composed of to be something more. I don't ever have a problem with my lines. Every now and then, I'll have a problem with some words. But then in my work, the next picture I did was MASH with Robert Altman, and he gave me the opportunity to exercise an improvisational flair that gave me enormous range.
What were the rules of the game on MASH when there was leeway to improvise? Where were you expected to improvise? How did that work?
That's very interesting, because when Ring Lardner Jr., who wrote the screenplay, finally saw the picture, most of us were outside waiting for him to come out to see how he felt about it. And he came out and was totally offended and furious. He said, "I haven't seen one of my words. And how could you have done that? And I'm devastated." And the result was that he won the Academy Award for the best screenplay. And at one point in the picture, where Robert Altman was composing this picture, I don't know that Donald and I knew what it was that he was doing, but he certainly knew what he was doing. And I was very energetic, and being that I wasn't being specifically directed, and being that I came from the precision of being a tap dancer and coming from the theater, I would intuitively fill my role with the energy and the heart that I felt was appropriate. And at one point, Bob Altman got very flustered because he was fighting time. We were going to break for lunch, and it was a scene that seemed to be rather non sequitur. And we were all sort of lying around across a brook, and I was talking about some relationship with a long-haired Oriental girl, and Bob had this shot coming across with a camera that was on a crane, and I distracted him. Alfred Hitchcock explained that to me later on, about anyone making themselves exceptional. But I wasn't trying to make myself exceptional. So at lunch, Bob Altman attacked me, and he said, "Why can't you be like Corey Fisher, who was very tall fellow who was also in Brewster McCloud from The Committee in San Francisco, which is sort of a satirical group, and I'm not a part of a satirical group." And I started to shake. I had my lunch on a tray. I hadn't eaten it yet, and I threw my lunch up without having eaten it. And I said, "Look, I am not going to stick my neck out for you again. You'll tell me exactly what you want, and that's exactly what I'll do. But don't don't treat me like this. And he said, I think I've made a mistake. I said, evidently you have made a mistake. He originally offered me the role of Duke, the part that Tom Skerritt played, the American Southerner. And I had just been fired from the theater. I was trying to do a play called A Way of Life, which is pretty funny, by Murray Shiskow. And I was fired. But because of my objective relationship with the camera, I didn't destroy myself. And I felt somewhat offended that I felt I was sculpturing a character, a role, to do 8 times a week in theater. And that the insecurity and the doubt of the establishment in relation to the materialism of the field, in the field, they sort of shattered my work. And I was somewhat offended because I had auditioned for it. And Shiskal had said to me, why can't you be as good in rehearsals as you were when you auditioned?
So what happened with Altman? Did you go back to improvising after that incident?
That was the day that Dick Rush came to visit me on the set to talk about doing Getting Straight. And Altman then gave me another scene that was not in the script, and it was a scene where we were playing poker. And the officer and his assistant from the other camp, who we played football with, came, and his assistant wore sunglasses that had mirrors on the outside. And Altman said, you're going to be playing poker with all the boys, and you're going to see that guy over your shoulder, and what I want you to say to him is there's 2 ways to get killed in this war. One is to go to the front lines and fight, and the other is just to stand over my shoulder with those glasses while I'm playing poker. And again, I played poker. I'm not the best poker player in the world, but I am an expert. And I was shining. It was so much fun for me. And I have found that when I'm radiating, the audience feels the same way as me. And Altman said, you ruined the scene. I said, oh, no. Oh, no. He said, yes, you're too outstanding. You take my mind away from my picture. I said, before you kill it, look at it. I think that it's going to come across as something. Because again, when he had offered me the part of Duke, I said, all I'll be doing will be justifying to my ear that I'm an American Southerner. And I'm very insecure that I'll offend legitimate people from that territory.
So the scene stayed in?
He said, you were right, and this scene stayed in. So then I said to Altman, but if you can give me the part of Trapper John, I've got real spirit and energy for you, and I think I can bring something to your picture.
Well, you must have finally got along well, because he cast you in The Long Goodbye and California Split.
California Split was a picture that I had lived before, and that's when we came into total harmony.
Well, I want to talk with you about that, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is actor Elliot Gould, and we'll talk more about his life and his work after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Elliot Gould is my guest. We just alluded to the fact that when Altman cast you in California Split, a movie about two gamblers, that it was a part you felt you had kind of lived.
No, I had lived it. The fellow who wrote it and co-produced it with Bob was a child actor, like myself, by the name of Joseph Walsh. And in real life, we gambled at a time. And I was, in real life, the character that George Segal played. And he was the character that I played.
What kind of things did you gamble on in real life?
Football, baseball, basketball, very few horses. I think there may have been one or two, boxing, and cards.
Was that, did you lose a lot of money or make a lot of money?
My philosophy now, which I'm enjoying, is that as much as I love to win, I hate losing more, and that there's nothing I need that I can win. I have to make it for myself. And with that in mind, and now being in balance and in harmony, occasionally I'll pay to play, because I enjoy the excitement, but I don't want to put myself in jeopardy or be at the mercy of anyone else.
Were you gambling at the time you made the movie?
Oh, yes. We built the casino in the upstairs at Mapes in Reno, and we would simulate the gambling scenes upstairs and then come down and gamble in the real place.
Right. In the last few years, I haven't seen you in as many movies as I would have liked to have seen you in. Is this choice on your part, or is there something else that's happened?
Well, I'm doing a lot of pictures now. I just wrote in this last several days to Ingmar Bergman on his island.
And you did a movie with him in 70 or 71 called The Touch.
1970, yeah, called The Touch. And Ingmar had said to me then that people thought he was crazy and that he wasn't, but that he worried about his health because he didn't know anyone who could continue his conscious work. And then he said, but now that we're working together, I know you can direct, so I'm not so afraid. Now, this past February, 1987, Liev Ullmann told me that he never said that to anyone before or since. I wanted to confirm that with his agent, Paul Koner, who was John Huston's only agent for John's entire career. And Paul said, this is true. There hasn't been anyone since you, and there wasn't anyone before you, and why didn't you use that as a cue to bring us a script? To which I replied, because my personal ambition is a distant second to my family, and my family has been so divided that until I could know that I've done everything possible and reached everyone, then I can start to concentrate to do my work. So I wrote to Ingmar within the last few days here in 1987 to tell him that I'm preparing to direct, but that I still must act to live, but I don't mind it too much because I appear to be improving, and that my children are wonderful and growing in every way, and that my wife is fine, and that Barbara wanted to know how he felt about Yentl.
This is Barbara Streisand, your first wife.
Yeah, mother of my first child, yeah.
You were in a movie a few months ago called Inside Out.
It's opening tomorrow in Los Angeles.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, it had opened in New York, I think, a few months ago.
I had one screen on Earth, which was my ideal, you know, one screen. I mean, I really believe that the human race must all come into the same computer.
So what's going to happen with this movie? You play an agoraphobic in it, someone who's basically afraid to leave the house.
I play someone who hasn't left his house in 4.5 years. I play someone who is, reflects the condition of the human race. Someone who is paranoid, extremely frightened, totally alienated, who thought or thinks that he could insulate himself against reality by not leaving his apartment, and everything that he's afraid of happens. So it was a great opportunity for an actor to get into this condition and for me to transmit information through the role. It's not a popular picture, nor is it a commercial picture, but I think it's a significant piece of work.
Are you still interested in comedy?
Oh, sure, I love comedy. I just had a meeting this morning with some British producer who wants me to do something called Run for Your Wife, which is a classic English drawing room comedy.
Do you think there's a connection between depression and comedy? Do you think that sometimes people who are given to depression off-screen are terrific stand-up comedians or comic actors?
I think anyone who strives to reach heights must also appreciate and accept depths. And last year, when my second television series didn't work, Together We Stand, which was an ideal of mine, Together We Stand, I thought it's okay to be a little depressed because I must work, and in relation to economy, in relation to reality, in relation to the unfortunate materialistic state of our environment, I was somewhat depressed because I have not been terribly realistic about my life in the world. But I thought, gee, with all these peaks and valleys, it's okay to feel depressed. It's all right to be a little sad, but I don't want to dwell in it. But I didn't know any limits. You see, Ingmar also said to me back then, prior to validating me as the next director, that he said, you've gone beyond your limits and you'll have to live more to understand what you've done. And at the moment, being that we were in production, we were at this 2,000-year-old church in 1970, B.B. Anderson, Ingmar Bergman, and me, I didn't have the confidence to say, stop everything. I don't think I'm doing anything different than anyone else. And if you see something I don't presume that I know what I'm doing. I don't know any limits, and I don't want to hurt myself. I need direction. I need you to work with me. I didn't have the confidence, so I couldn't stop. But that was also part of my design, because I feel that people are so blind to the reality of nature and what it is we have to share, that I wanted to come as far out as possible to get a picture of what's going on here and then try to make my way back, which I am.
So now you feel you have more confidence.
I have confidence. I had no confidence before. Now I have.
Are you getting offered the kind of roles that you want?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of being offered roles. I've done everything that I intended to do, and now I want to develop my own product and make my own pictures. In terms of my ambition, I'm very ambitious, and my great ambition is to be a great-great-grandfather, so as that I can know the children of the children's children's children. Now, I am a father, which is my favorite role, and I hope someday to be a grandfather, and so and on and on. I like being me very much, and look forward to living the next moment as well as now.
One last question. Do you like to watch your older movies? Do you ever go back and watch them?
My older movies come out here, so I don't have to go back to. They're being projected, so I don't have to go back to see them. My older movies have legs and propel themselves into the future. I've told my children and my friends that some of my pictures are better and some of my pictures aren't, but that there's something in every one of my pictures. I'm living and I'm alive in every one.
Elliot Gould, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here. My guest has been actor Elliot Gould. He's best known for his roles in the films MASH, The Long Goodbye, and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. His new movie, Inside Out, opens this week in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.